Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. On this episode, we're going to be talking about building a cloud community with an AWS community hero who's been involved in an AWS user group, the Brown Bag, and VTUG. It's Chris Williams. He has a lot of interesting and insightful information about what you need to do if you want to run a user group or how you can be a better attendee. What stuck out to you, Ethan?
Well, we get really practical with it. That's what sticks out. We talk about the logistics. We talk about money. We talk about dealing with sponsors. We talk about how to pick a venue. We talk about how often you should meet. All of that stuff that really matters, the nuts and bolts of running and participating in a user group.
Yeah, it went surprisingly deep. I didn't know how much was going on in the background, and now I have a lot more respect for those people who actually stand up and do all of this stuff. So enjoy this conversation with Chris Williams, an AWS community hero. Chris Williams, welcome to Day 2 Cloud. In a few words, why don't you tell the listeners who you are and what you do?
Hey, everybody. My name is Chris Williams, and I am a multi-cloud consultant, and I work for Worldwide Technology. There, I help our customers migrate to the cloud, learn about strategy, business decisions, why you want to go to the cloud, how to get there. I'm steeped in both the business aspects and heavily into the technology aspects as well. I'm also an AWS community hero, and I earned that because of all of the extra community work that I do for AWS and for other technologies.
So since you're a multi-cloud consultant, that means you understand every service in every cloud that's available, right?
That is highly inaccurate. I have a large contingent of people behind me that are steeped in each of the individual thousands of services. I have a good understanding of a lot of them, but no one human on the planet knows everything about all of them.
Oh, curses, because we were going to do a deep dive into Athena on AWS, but I guess we're just going to have to pivot to something else. I don't know.
We should just use a dartboard, pick a thing, and then just go as deep as we can into it. Pick a service, any service. Let's go.
This is going to be a really, really short podcast.
Now, and we're done.
So instead, I want to talk about what earned you that AWS community hero, which congratulations, that's a pretty big deal, right?
Thank you. Yeah, it's the other folks that have gotten it. They do incredible amounts of work in the community. I aspire to do what they do. It's a lot of extra hours afterwards after work. And honestly, I mean there's a process by which people are nominated internally and they get voted into it. But it's a bit of a black box from the outside. We don't know what it takes to do what you have to do to get it. I just know that I did a lot and they anointed me with the award.
Yeah, I'll say it. You obviously are doing a lot. You know, looking at your profile and your various online presences, we saw you've been involved with VTUG, an AWS user group, and V Brown Bag. So that's three different things. Can you talk a little bit about each of those groups? What are they for and what do they focus on?
Sure, absolutely. So the VTUG is the Virtualization Technology User Group. You can see the website at vtug.org. It's been defunct for about a year now. It had been around for about 15 or 16 years, and it was the original VMware user group. The VTUG actually precedes the VMUGs, but what they wanted to do is they wanted to be virtualization agnostic. So we wanted to have Hyper-V, we wanted to have VMware, we wanted to have Rackspace, we wanted to have speakers from all the different technologies in the room, so that everybody could learn about the pros and cons of all the different virtualization streams. So that was around for about 15 or 16 years, and we spun that down last year. The AWS user group is the Portsmouth user group, so we call it the Pug, and our logo is actually a little pug, and he's adorable, and we love him, and I'll give everybody stickers that wants them, and that obviously is AWS centric. One of the cool things about what AWS does is they don't have a heavy hand in what we do. So we can talk about cloud. I mean, it's obviously got an AWS focus, but we can actually do pros and cons of other services. Like, how does blob storage compare to S3 and stuff like that. And that's really cool. And V Brown Bag, that is an online weekly podcast. We've got five different time zones, EMEA, LATAM, US, Asia Pac. And we, we kind of talk about everything. I first got involved with them back when I was passing my VCIXs. I was going for my VMware implementation expert, and they have tons of great content on there for VMware. But then I saw all this stuff on Git and all this stuff on GitHub, and then I did a year of Python with them. So it's kind of like whatever tickles our fancy from like a really high level, from a really deep dive technical perspective. So we did Commitmas, like the 12 days of Commitmas, GitHub Commitmas, play on words. And we all just kind of like, wouldn't it be cool if we did X? And then we just, find, seven, people that are just like the preeminent people in that field, and we talk about it for like seven episodes, and it's super amazing.
Chris, hang on a second.
Yes,
you got
yes.
started a bunch of certifications. You're involved in all of these community groups, and you have a day job. Don't you have enough to do? How can you also be involved in all of these community volunteer kind of things too?
There's no kids in the house anymore. we just have cats. No, it's like I'm a hyper extrovert. I love being out there. Ned and I met at Cloudfield Day 6, and you kind of have to be a hyper extrovert to want to do these kinds of things. We were breaking down the personality types of the people that get involved in community, and it's just something I do. I like doing it, and I also get a lot out of it too, because it keeps me fresh. I keep learning. I love sharing knowledge because it helps me and it helps everybody else too. Kind of like, all boats rise with the tide. So it's it is a time suck, but it's not as much as everybody thinks it is. There's a lot of work on the front end to get things spun up, and there's a little bit of work, per episode or per meetup or whatever like that to keep things going, but it's not as big of a commitment as everybody thinks it is.
What I'm curious about is you kind of articulated why you get involved in all of these different community groups, and you're involved on the leadership side of things or the presenter side of things. Mm-hmm. Is it different for the attendees at the user groups? Do they get something different out of it? And with all these different communities, we listed three, and I know there's others out there. Do you get involved in different communities to serve different goals in your career and life?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So let's split that apart into two things: leaders versus attendees. Yeah. Yes. It's very different. If you're an attendee, then you get your knowledge, you get your free pizza and beer, and you get to meet people in the industry, and you get to make connections. And if you're looking for a job or something like that, then it's a really good mechanism for an employment opportunity. From the leadership perspective, you can't get sloppy drunk. you have to make sure everybody gets home safe. There's a lot of responsibility, especially for the larger organization. Like, so for VTUG, when we rent out Gillette Stadium and we've got, 1500 people there, we've got to make sure everybody gets fed, make sure everybody gets there, make sure everybody gets home safely. Make sure everybody's got a hotel room if they need one. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of care and feeding from that perspective, and you can't let your hair down as much. Well, you can't let your hair down as much as you can if you're an attendee.
Right.
I really enjoyed being an attendee. But my passion for learning and my passion for sharing knowledge kind of like, I got volunteered into all of these positions. I didn't start anything. Chris and Don Harney started VTUG, and 10 years into it or 13 years into it, they saw me as a very, very active member, and they said, "Hey, why don't you come help us out?" Mm-hmm. Same with V Brownback. They helped me pass my VCIX4, or was it 5? Whatever. And I met Al and John Fraps at VMworld one time, and I said, "You guys are great. Is there anything I can do to help?" And they're like, "Well, actually," and so they volunteered me. And so I've been doing that ever since. And same with the Pug. Steve and Tim had started, they hadn't had their first episode yet, their first meetup yet. And I was the third person that signed up for it. And I was like, hey guys, have you guys thought about this? Have you thought about that? Have you worked this out? Cause I'd been doing community for a long time at that point. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no. And would you like us to help us? And so I started helping them out, and that's just spun up into something really big and nice. So yeah, I'm just a tagger on. I'm a follower.
Nonetheless, you got a bunch of experience, Chris. So let's pick your brain, man. Let's get into starting user group. And I'll confess, part of this is pretty selfish on my part. I've been thinking about starting user group of my own for a while. Haven't gotten there quite yet because reasons. I was involved with the Boston Network Operators Group for a while, helping organize some of that stuff a few years back when that was active. It's not really an active group at the moment. But let's say I want to start a user group, because I do. How should I set up the leadership structure? Should I like elect myself benevolent dictator for life? Or should I seek some other people who want to help me run the group? And if so, how many other people is enough people to make a thing go like this?
So yeah, you do not want to nominate yourself benevolent dictator for life, because you will burn out. That's the last thing you want to do. You want to have at least three people running a user group. And a user group is a user group. I mean, it's all about the community. I call myself an organizer. I call myself like a co-organizer or whatever like that. I mean, I'm just kind of doing what the folks want to do. We take a list of, we send everybody a Google Doc, and we say, hey, what do you want to learn about? And the thing that gets the most hits is the thing that I try to go find a speaker for. So you want to have 2, 3, 4 people. That way you can divvy up the work, because any one person doing an entire user group, it's going to be too much. Cause everybody does have a day job, and you know, most people have kids or prior commitments or things outside of doing this. Definitely at least three humans total minimum.
Minimum three humans. Let's say, you know, Ethan's made that decision. He's going to venture out into the world of new user group. He's got two other human beings. Hopefully they're human lined up.
Good luck.
And they're all going to collectively start this awesome new user group. How do they let the world know? How do you start getting people to actually come to your user group? Because it'd be kind of sad if it was just Ethan and those two other humans and a whole bunch of pizza and beer. I mean, not that sad, but no, a little bit
not,
sad.
Not too bad.
You want people to show up.
Right. So it depends on what you're trying to go for. So like for the AWS Portsmouth user group, we were unfortunate in the fact that there's the Boston user group, you know, 45 minutes south of us. But there's a large community on the North Shore. So for everybody listening, Ethan and I are actually in the New England area together. We're about an hour apart from each other. So when I start talking about regionality, Ned, please clarify if we're getting to like, oh, you know, take a left at Littleton and you're right there. It's easy. Just tell us to shut up. The North Shore, north of Boston, they don't want to drive into Boston. That's awful. So what we wanted to start a user group in the Portsmouth area, so that people north of Massachusetts, north of Boston, and in New Hampshire and in Southern Maine could come and come to a user group that's convenient, easy, and low traffic. Mm-hmm. So you have to define the need, convenience and need. There's a user group in Atlanta, Georgia, that's inside an office space from the company where the guy that works at the office. He basically runs it in the daytime, and it's 25 minutes to drive there one way. So he's asking people on their lunch break to drive a total of 50 minutes to grab 5 minutes of AWS knowledge, and he's wondering why he can't get attendees other than the people that are actually working in the office space. I'm like, well, know your audience. So when you're trying to spin this up, you want to set up your meetup. You want to advertise it out there. Get it out on Twitter. Get it out on Facebook groups. Every community, every region has their own certain thing. In the Lakes region. And when I say the Lakes region, I mean the Great Lakes, not the New Hampshire Lakes. Meetingplace.io is now supplanting meetup.com. So, mm-hmm. So they're now all phasing over that. So you kind of have to know your region. I don't know what's like in the San Francisco region, that's rife with user groups. There's like six AWS user groups just in the Bay Area. So you have to know, you know, how many people are you going to potentially attract, and then, you know, get the word out, you know, advertising in a newspaper. That's a bit archaic. That's probably not going to work, but there is something that will work in your area. For here, it was meetup.com was, you know, that worked. I have like a good following on Twitter, from people in the local area because of my work with VTUG. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get out the word about that from the VTUG area as well. So one user group springboarded off another user group. And I've been communicating with the other user group leaders in the local area too. So Brian Tarbox down in Boston, we cross pollinate advertising with each other. So I tell him what's going on up here. He lets his users know, and vice versa. So it's just kind of getting your name out there, learning who's the other leaders, and, you know, chatting with them and saying, hey, can you help me out? Because everybody wants to help. Everybody's been very, very helpful in this space.
Yeah. We had a similar situation with not the AWS user groups, but actually the Azure user groups down in Philadelphia near where I am. There was a Azure Philly that was kind of meeting inside Philly. And then there was another Azure user group, which was meeting in King of Prussia, which is about 45 minutes outside of Philadelphia. And it was a lot of the same reasons you talked about. People who didn't live in Philadelphia didn't want to drive into Philadelphia for a user group because it's painful and parking and all of those logistics, where they could just drive to this business park in King of Prussia, about the same, might even be the same drive time, but it's just not as, you know, stressful.
Right.
But they also did cross-pollination. They would do events together to try to drum up a bigger audience, especially if one of them wrangled like a really good speaker that was hard to get. Yeah, we'll combine them together and say, hey, we'll do this one together because we got this awesome speaker, or something like that, to really entice the folks to come out. And then if you get a few new people, maybe they'll keep coming.
Yep, exactly. And that's kind of how this all spawns off of each other. There's no, you know, starting one of these things in a vacuum. You learn from the people around you. Down in Boston, Brian was doing this really cool thing with his Zoom sessions. I was like, oh, that's a great idea. I'm going to do that. And then I tried something new, and he's like, oh, that's a great idea. I'm going to try that. So nothing is new under the sun.
You got tips on how often a user group should meet, Chris?
In person, I want to say, depending upon the size and depending upon the venue. So the VTUG, we rented Gillette Stadium for the events. So we did that twice a year. That's a bigger event. It's a heavier lift. You need more people involved. The AWS Portsmouth user group, the PUG, that's monthly because it's, you know, 40, 50 people and we can get together quickly. The V Brown Bag, because of the audience size and because of the after eyeballs that come from after the recordings, that has to be online. There's no way that we could gather physically present, with the exception of conferences where I meet up with Al or John to, like, you know, hash out ideas.
Now, you said monthly for the PUG. Why monthly and not weekly or not quarterly?
Not weekly because there's not enough speakers that are willing to come out and do the content to make it worthwhile, and not quarterly because people would lose interest and forget about it and not show up. Monthly, you know, the second Tuesday of every month, everybody just has it written in their head. This is where I'm going to be. If you set it up every 3 months, then your attendance just falls off a cliff. People forget about it. And, you know, things come up in their lives. Yeah. So for us, for the size of the PUG and for the type of knowledge monthly, and from the knowledge perspective too, like, you know, the refresh point, how many times can you talk about EC2 instances or Lambda or serverless or whatever? I mean, there's no way you're going to get a speaker for every one of the 200 plus services and then be able to stagger them out. Even if you could, you couldn't stagger them out for 52 weeks out of the year. And then, this time next year, we'll talk about serverless again. That's logistically impossible.
So for the times that the group isn't meeting, but you want to have a sense of cohesion, is there a Slack group that would be worth creating, or build a website, that kind of thing?
So we do have a website. We do have a Slack channel. Slack isn't, it's not, it's great for just disseminating information. People sign up for it, but I'm not seeing a whole lot of, like, just organic chatter in the Slack. And that's just for the PUG, and for the VTUG, honestly. For V Brown Bag, we actually just started a Reddit channel the other day, and we're going to see how that works. to see if people just start asking questions organically in there. Slack is great for like inter-office communication, or if you've got a group of people that are definitely going towards a goal or a project or something like that. But just for like idle chit chat, everybody's got so many Slack channels that, you know, to flip down to the 17th Slack channel to add a little bit of a contribution it's kind of a heavy ask.
I've got so many Slack channels. I don't even keep them open all anymore. I'm in about that 17 or something like that, but there's about a half a dozen I can keep up with. And one of them is a meetup group that I'm a part of. And there's some chatter in there. I don't even look at it. I can't.
Yeah. Can't even. Ain't nobody got time for that.
So Slack is mostly free, but there's some features you might have to pay for. Where you're meeting might cost some money to get the space unless someone can donate it. And running a website, that costs money. So I guess the thing that I'm getting down to here is running a user group is not free.
Correct.
In terms of time and also resources. So how do you raise that money? Do you charge people to attend, get sponsors? Like what's the strategy for funding your user group?
So for the website, so AWS Pug basically gives us credits. So our website is actually run on AWS, and we use the compute credits that are given to us by AWS to run that. So aside from the actual work that we put into it, that's free. The meeting space, there's a lot of areas around here that have meeting spaces. So when I was working for Green Pages, we did the events in Green Pages. They loved having it there. There was a great conference room area where we could do it. Now with the pandemic and everything, all of the meetups are on Zoom. So we plunked down a little bit of money for that. I had a hard time with this when I was first starting doing user groups. I felt like I was panhandling, going out to the sponsors and ask, please, sir, can I have a shekel to run our user group? And the marketing director from Green Pages, he kind of corrected my thinking on that. And it was very invaluable advice. So let's use this as part of the highlight reel. When you approach a sponsor, you are doing them the best service that you could possibly do. You are putting active listener butts in seats to listen to potentially their product pitch. That is gold to any IT organization that is trying to sell a thing. So I learned after that that I shouldn't go out and say, please, you know, can you give us a dollar so we can run it? I'm like, give me money, because these are the kinds of things I'm lining up for you. You're welcome. Cash money now. And that worked out really, really well. I did an AWS community day. So AWS also has these community days, and I did the first community day in New England. And halfway through that process, I was really stressing about the sponsorship and, you know, getting enough money to pay for this hotel. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to come up with the money for this. And then that's when the director told me that. And I immediately pivoted my pitch. And I had more sponsors than I knew what to do with at that point. I mean, I literally had more money than I thought. I actually was able to afford to get, you know, videographers per room and all this. I was amazed at how just the change in my attitude changed the ability to generate money for that thing.
And what do the sponsors actually get in return from that? Just the ability to stand up and talk about their thing? Or is there, you know, branding? Is there like a package you would put together for them?
Yeah. So what we did was we gave them a tiered sheet. So for X dollars, you can have a sponsorship breakout room and you can talk about your product in the sponsorship breakout room. For X plus dollars, you can have a table in the expo hall and you can, you know, give away a tchotchke and do a thing. And for X plus plus dollars, then you can be on the marquee and you can have, you know, your name up in lights as a platinum sponsor and do all that stuff. And, you know, just basically higher and higher levels of opportunity for them. And, you have to also be careful because, you know, they're always going to ask you for the attendee list and all the email addresses. And I'm like, no, if they come up to your booth and they voluntarily give you their email address and they want you to contact them, then that's fine. But I'm not just going to give you the list of everybody that showed up to it.
Did they bring sales staff? So you got some salesperson kind of hanging around. Yeah.
Yeah. They'll have, you know, t-shirt, you know, poloed sales staff to, you know, pitch the product or whatever like that. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, as long as they're not being too heavy handed about it.
Yeah. Some of the conferences that I've been to and to a lesser degree, some of the user groups, but if they're doing like a full day, that does require that kind of sponsorship. They have the expo hall, or sometimes it's just like a little hallway with some booths. And sometimes that feels like the walk of doom because they always put it between where the talks are and where the food is. And you're like, man, I got to go, got to run the gauntlet.
Got to run the gamut here. Bam, bam, just elbows and shoulders everywhere.
Yeah. So I guess, how do you strike that balance between sponsorship and marketing and the people who are attending not getting too annoyed about the fact the sponsors are there?
Well, I mean, by and large, I think most of the attendees understand the need for that. I mean, if the sponsors aren't there, then there's no event. And I try to get sponsors that have relevance to the topics. I'm not gonna, you know, have a hardware vendor show up to a public cloud exclusive. I'm not gonna have a hardware vendor show up to a serverless conference, you know. So I try to make sure that, you know, it's a right fit. And that it's something that most people potentially would want to talk to anyway. And I, you know, even for the breakout rooms, I'm like, you know, you're paying for this room, so you get to do a commercial, but give them something that they can chew on. Don't make this, you know, just a, and now for the low, low price of $9.95, you too can own a whatever. So it is a fine balance. But without the sponsors, the event doesn't happen. So, right. and most attendees get that. Most attendees don't, you know, I will always have attendees that complain about the free food. So I kind of tune them out after a while.
Everybody complains about the food. I mean, that's a given. It doesn't matter how good it is.
with the vendors hanging around, Chris, though, does that discourage what I would call real talk? That is, you know, we're being really honest about our product experiences, and sometimes those are negative experiences. So do people tend to clam up because they're worried they're going to offend a vendor?
No, the opposite, I would say. Most people relish the opportunity to skewer a vendor, especially if they're like, if they're working on a product and that product owner is standing in front of them. Most attendees love raking them over the coals and saying, "Oh, this feature is phooey." Watch my words.
And now it's time for the airing of grievances.
Here's my aluminum pole. It's definitely attendees are not shy, especially IT attendees. Come on. I mean, we've been in that room where all the guys that finally have a chance with the product manager to like, let them know what they really think about the drivers from 1973 on the back motherboard of the thing with the, you know, and they're wearing their Jordy LaForge glasses. And of course they are, because why wouldn't they be?
Right. I think that actually pivots me to another thing that I wanted to bring up, because you have that potentially noisy neighbor problem when it comes to some of these conferences. Yep. And sometimes people just, they don't know how to act. Hmm. Does your user group have a code of conduct? Do they need one? And how do you go about like developing that and enforcing it?
So yes and yes, we do have a code of conduct. I stole it. I plagiarized it mercilessly from the best code of conduct that I ever saw in my life, which was the code of conduct for the Python conference, PyCon. I went to my first PyCon in, I want to say 2018, and it was the best code of conduct I've ever read. It was so inclusive. It was so, you know, don't be a jerk. But explicitly writing it out in how exactly not to be a jerk, that I just like, I'm cut, paste here, use Pug, read this. So sometimes I've had to have hard conversations. Sometimes, you know, people get a little bit too drunk when they're at one of these things, and you have to like, you know, walk them to the side and have some stern words with them. Well, you don't have stern words with them while they're hammered and slobbering over somebody. You walk them back to the hotel, and then after, you know, a day later, you have stern words with them. But everybody has positive intent. Everybody's there to learn and have a good time and you know, get something out of it. As far as the enforcement of said code of conduct, it's, you know, it's a I used to be a bouncer, so I don't have a problem enforcing codes of conduct. Stop that. Don't do that. But you know, it's just a conversation. Everybody, most people are rational thinking adults. I usually don't have problems with that. But if somebody runs into any problem like that, we can start an Ask Chris channel, like an Ask Ann Landers channel. And I can tell them how to deal with some potential bad actors.
Could you give us some tips on how to select a venue, Chris? Because this seems to be the thing that was a struggle for some of the groups that I've been involved with. Just finding the right place, how to get people to it. Should it be the same place every time, or should we mix it up, and you know, and so on?
What size are we talking about? Like for let's assume 50 or 1,000.
50. Go with a smaller group. Yeah.
So with the smaller groups, I would recommend sticking with one venue, something that's got a large space. I guess right now it depends. I mean, are we talking about post-pandemic times? Or are we talking about right now? Because right now it's just Zoom channels.
Yeah, I know. Let's assume that there's a world where we're physically going to be able to get back together in our small groups. And maybe that's a year away from when we're recording this or more.
In a world where we don't have to... No, sorry.
Right.
So post-pandemic, we've all got a vaccine. We can all hang out together again. Pick a place that can comfortably seat 50 plus people. I recommend, depending upon what it is you're trying to teach and depending upon your presenter's strengths, either doing round tops where everybody is like at a table format and having the speaker on one side, or just do like student seating where everybody can like line up. You can pack more people in with student seating. You can pack less people in with the round tops. So depending upon how many people show up, you can pivot from that perspective. And I would make sure that you have not a whiteboard, something upon which people can present. You know, they can plug in their laptop, they can have an overhead projector. Most presenters will bring their own pointer, or at least keep the laptop close enough by they can hit the space bar. I like having alcohol at the events. So I tend to shy away from community colleges and places like that where you can't. So we have a community college close by, and it's very convenient, but the room changes each time. So you can never have like a guaranteed space in one room. So the attendees are always like wandering around trying to figure out where the event is. And you can't have beer and pizza. You can have pizza and seltzer. You can have pizza and whatever, but you can't have beer and pizza. And that tends to be people want to go to a thing after work. They want to, you know, relax a little bit. They want to have a beer and a pizza, and they want to learn something. So I tend to go for places where you can have an adult beverage and some food. And I try to stay consistent with the place so that people know where they're going every time.
Is food potentially a problem where there might be a venue that seems good, but it's like, oh no, you can't bring food in here?
If you go to a restaurant or if you go to a brewery or something that has their own food on prem, then you cannot bring in pizza. You can't bring food to a place that sells food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's the only catch for that.
If people whined at you about like, oh, I need to be able to take the bus or a subway to get to the venue, and you're 2 miles away from the nearest stop. Been there.
No,
that's a real specific question.
I was like, wow, that's wow.
So, well, that actually is the thing. Cause you know, in one of our Bosnog meetings we had at what seemed like a, you know, reasonable place, but where the subway line ended was about 2 miles from the venue, as it turned out, which doesn't seem like it's a far thing until you don't have a car and you're like trying to grab an Uber from the bus station to get up to the, you know, that last leg. So those are things that are worth thinking about.
So if a lot of the people had said something about that, then I would think about moving the venue. If it's a couple of people, I would encourage them to start their own user group and they could place it wherever they want to.
You can put that wherever you want.
And does the venue typically do stuff for you, like set up chairs or do some catering or anything? Or
depending, like, so if it's a community college, no, then you're moving everything around on your own and you know, bringing in the pizza and whatnot. If you are paying money for your venue, then find out ahead of time what they're going to bring to the table. Because most of the time it will be setups. It will be like, you know, putting tablecloths down and you know, having a nicer area. You know, if it's free, then you get what you get. But if you're paying money for it, then you should be getting setup time, AV, some signage. There's a lot of, you know, if you're going to have an expo hall for like some of the larger events, if you are going to have an expo hall, then you want to make sure that every sponsor has a table and power to the table. So that they can take care of their stuff.
Yeah. And another thing that has come up to ones that I've gone to is there was an expectation of what technology would be available for presenting. Mm-hmm. And when you show up, the facility hasn't provided what they may have said or, you know, you assumed would be there. So as a, yeah. I guess as a leader, you have to be prepared for those situations and maybe have that little projector back in the car.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Just in case.
You know. So we have a fold-out pull-down projector for emergency presentations.
Like on the side of the road. You're like, man, I need to do...
I got
to
present.
Fast five.
I got to present. Oop. You're on the side of I-95. You're causing car wrecks. If you can see here, the spreadsheet says, and people are falling asleep on the road. It's terrible.
Well, nothing puts people to sleep like PowerPoint, does it? Let's say... In theory, Ethan is running his user group and it is going awesome. He's found the perfect venue. He's getting great attendance, but he's starting to burst at the seams a little bit. Like the venue might seem a little small. At what point do you jump to a bigger venue or do you start just being more restrictive about the number of people that can attend? Do you ever turn people away or do you just find somewhere that'll accommodate additional attendees?
When people subscribe and say, when people RSVP to meetup.com and they say, yes, I'm going to go, that number you can just throw out the window because that number of people is not going to show up. Yeah. I have found that it's 50%. If 50 people RSVP, 25 will show up. If 100 people mm-hmm. RSVP, 50 will show up.
That's, I was going to say like a third to a half. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you do something like we did for the community day, which is we charged everybody, we used Eventbrite and we charged everybody $5. That was refundable when they showed up. So we got to 80%. We got to 80% attendees. But you show up and then you get your $5 back. If you don't show up, that's the cost of admission. You didn't show up, you forfeit your $5. It's not so onerous that it's putting people, you know, in the poorhouse. But it's enough to like actually make people remember, oh yeah, I put five down for this. I should probably show up for it. And that the people that didn't show up, that money paid for everybody else's lunch. So it was a win-win.
Oh, yeah, I like that strategy.
We were talking earlier, Chris, about like monthly was a good cadence for a lot of these things. Well, when do you do it? Lunchtime, you know, weeknight, weekend? And then occasionally do you do a half day or a full day kind of a thing?
So never a weekend. Nobody will ever show up. we do it Tuesday night, the second Tuesday of every month. And the reason why we picked the second Tuesday of every month was because the Boston user group was the third Tuesday of every month. Mm-hmm. And the you know, we looked at all the different other meetup groups in the area that other people could potentially be signed up for. Excuse me. And we said, okay, It seems like there's a dearth on the second Tuesday of the month of AWS groups. So let's plunk this down here, you know, stick our claim in the sand and say, okay, second Tuesday of the month, AWS in Portsmouth, done. So that was the reason why we picked that. You never do it on a Friday because nobody's going to show up on a Friday. Never do it on the weekends. Mm-hmm. Monday nights, I mean, it just seems like Tuesday seems to be the best time for it. We've played around with Thursdays and Wednesdays and stuff like that. And it was just Tuesday worked out for everybody for our area. We asked our attendees, you know, what's the best night for you guys? And everybody was down. Not everybody, most people, the more than 50% was down for Tuesday.
And you're saying night. I mean, no one's going to show up like we're going to do it 11:30 to 2 in the middle of the day. Come take your extended lunch hour. And no,
we have not tried that because of the places where we do our meetups. It's a workplace. So Green Pages is a place where people are working during the day.
Yep.
Okay. So they're not going to want a parade of people coming up for that. Great Bay Community College, that's a college. They have classes during the daytime. Mm-hmm. Well, they used to. And so they didn't, you know, they didn't want us coming around during the daytime. If you have a place where you can do, you know, and people aren't going to want to drive in, you know, like I said about the Atlanta group, they're not going to want to drive in, you know, 25 minutes, sit there for 5 minutes to try to learn something real fast and then drive 25 minutes back on their 1 hour lunch break.
So, okay. So speaking of this, the presentations and the context of learning, does every meeting in your opinion have to have some kind of a presentation, or is it okay sometimes for the user group just to be, everyone gets together and they chat and whatever happens, happens?
I like to have a presentation or at least a generic topic to talk about, like, you know, have like a serverless day or somebody talk about that. So we invariably, we've always had a presenter, but that's because there's a lot of people here in the area. We're very fortunate. We have a lot of people that, that want to talk. I also like having the just chat sessions as well. For those types of, and it doesn't have to be a 45 minute presentation. My friend over in Indianapolis, Calvin, he has his user group breaks it up into three 20 minute presentations, and then just stack them back to back. Like, you know, if you want to just get into starting to talk about a topic, or if you want to work on the cadence of a presentation that you want to do for a larger audience, your 20 minute slot where you can just, you know, practice it or whatever. It's a very welcoming format, and you're not under pressure to talk for 45 minutes straight. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that 45 minute block, that can be very daunting to someone who isn't a seasoned presenter. They look at that and they're like, how do I even talk for that long? Even 20 minutes might seem a little daunting. So I've seen a couple of user groups do lightning talks at the beginning. So, you know, 5-10 minutes max, and then have the full presentation after those lightning talks. So for those people who are a little bit nervous and maybe aren't comfortable doing a longer presentation, it gives them a chance to dip their toe in.
Yep.
As attendees, you know, continue to come to your user group, hopefully they're developing a sense of ownership and you know, belonging to that user group. And obviously some of them might end up volunteering to either help out or speak. How do you foster that level of care and ownership with the attendees?
I usually tell them to do it. No. No, so we foster it by starting and stopping every meeting by saying, this is a community group. If you guys want to take this in a certain way, let us know. If you guys want to help pitch in to help lead this, please let us know. We've actually cycled through a couple of different organizers by doing exactly that. So some people have peeled off because they got too busy, and other people have come on because they started having some cycle time. And the recent batch of people that are helping right now are fantastic, and they're bringing like new ideas and new blood to it. And I think that's why Chris and Don Harney brought me into the VTUG, was to like inject some new ideas and new excitement and new blood into the VTUG as well. And we foster it, we encourage it, we definitely want people to, you know, step up and not like, you know, be the leader. There is no the leader. It's all, mm-hmm. we're all working together to, like, you know, come to a common consensus of, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? And as long as everybody communicates openly and doesn't, you know, try to, you know, make it go in the direction that they want it to go and everybody else disagrees with it, then it works out very well.
There's also the downside to that, where some attendees might try to hijack the talk with their own personal gripes, or, you know, eat all the food and give nothing back. My favorite is when a presenter is done and they're like, any questions? And somebody's like, not so much a question, but more of a comment. And everybody's just like, oh God, it's this guy again. What do you do about those people that are acting in a fashion that might not be a violation of code conduct, but isn't helpful to the group?
I usually take them aside and have a talk with them. I usually can immediately think of the seven people that I've that are those people in my groups. They all have positive intent. They all want to learn about something, and sometimes they do want to like do a little bit of a brain flex to show, you know, how smart they are or whatever like that. And that's fine. I mean, you know, we're all humans. I usually, you know, take them aside, have a little chat with them. I'm like, okay, this is a user group. This is for the entire community. If you want to have if you want to bogart a conversation with this guy, do it, you know, get his email address, get her Twitter handle or something like that, and engage them on a DM. But, you know, you trying to fix your particular problem for your project from your office. He's not tech support for you and this thing you have paid tech support for Salesforce or whatever right. widget they're trying to do an integration for. Don't bring your Jira ticket to the community. Right. And they get that. I mean, you know, everybody comes because they want to learn and they want to get something out of it. So they get that. And invariably they'll be like, okay, you're right. I'll take it offline. And I'm like, okay, moving on.
Here we go.
Chris, what's your take about either live streaming the event or just recording and then posting content after the event? Because the logic is, I don't have to go. I can watch it later. So some people just wouldn't bother show up and isn't live attendance kind of part of the attraction of a user group?
So V Brown Bag does it really well. We just hit the record button at the beginning of it. We record the whole thing, bumps and bruises, ums and ahs, everything, you know, included. And then we hit stop at the end and then we post it. But we have a live audience of anywhere from, you know, 10 to 50 people. And I love getting that organic Q&A. I love getting the immediate feedback and the comments and the questions in there. Does it detract from the actual eyeballs if you're not recording it? Maybe. But at this point, with the level of technology that we have nowadays, it would behoove us to not, I mean, we can't not record. Mm-hmm. whether we do anything in post-production is you know, I don't have time for that. That's where I draw the line. You know, heavy video editing is where I stop. I'm not a video editor and I don't have the money to pay for one. But I encourage people to, you know, hit the record button and then post it up. You know, all content is good content. We do that for the AWS Pug. We did it for the VTUG. We've always done it for V Brown Bag. I love having a live audience, but I also love recording it and being able to review it and look at it later as well.
Yeah, plus V beer isn't as good as real beer. So
that is absolutely true. There's that. Absolutely.
But of course, right now we are in the pandemic era. So what is your take on virtual user groups, virtual events? How have you been handling that?
The V Brown Bag had always been virtual. So for me, it wasn't as heavy of a pivot to go from that for the Pug. For some of the attendees, it was. A lot of the attendees had to learn to Zoom, which is, it's weird to say that because you think that everybody's in IT and everybody's like good at video conferencing and stuff like that. But, you know, hot mic incidents abound, you know, screaming two-year-old set right in front of the laptop. I'm like, what are you doing? What's going on here? So I think after a little bit of a learning curve, people have gotten better now. We've had two episodes or two meetups since the pandemic started, and the back and forth has gotten significantly better. It's not as broken up. I prefer live. I love live. I would rather have people in the room with me. That's just my makeup. It's there. 80% of communication is nonverbal, you know, hand gestures, facial features, eye rolling. I've seen, you know, tomato throwing. I love all that stuff. So I'd prefer to have it live. But, you know, deal with the hand you're dealt.
But you've maintained continuity of the group through just basically Zoom, it sounds like. You're doing the same thing you were, only Zoom is your platform and not a live room.
Yes, correct. Absolutely. And we're still chatting at the beginning of it. We still tee up the presenter. We still, you know, I haven't played too much with breakout rooms yet. My buddy Calvin has been doing that. He's doing basically like the online IT version of speed dating, where he just breaks up like a large 50 user group into rooms of five, I think it's like even numbers. And then they break off and they chat for like 15 minutes each. And then they all come back into the main room and he shuffles them all up again and they go back out. So we haven't played with that yet. It sounds kind of interesting. I'm going to attend some of his meetups to see how that works. And if that jives well, then I might incorporate that into our program as well.
I like the sound of that. A good way for people to be, especially if they're particularly introverted, don't want to speak out in a very large group, but they can still get to know other people and have, you know, a more personal, more intimate conversation, as opposed to it's you and 50 other people in the Zoom room and no one wants to say anything. So I like that speed dating idea.
Yeah. And I like the smaller rooms because it is Zoom. And so everybody's stepping on each other's mic anyway, and people are popping up into focus all the time anyway. So the fewer people in the room, the more chance people actually get to be heard.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And Overall, this has been absolutely fantastic information. I think Ethan is almost ready to pull the trigger on this user group thing. Why don't you, Chris, can you tee up some key takeaways for Ethan and for the listeners about user groups? What should they think about if they want to start one or get more involved?
If you want to get more involved, jump onto meetingplace.io or meetup.com or whatever your local regional meeting venue du jour is, Facebook groups, whatever. See what's out there. See what is currently being offered, and then jump in, reach out to the leaders, say, hey, I want to help, or hey, I want to start a group. And this is the topic. What do you think about this? I mean, don't walk up to the AWS Portsmouth user group leader and say, hey, I want to start AWS Portsmouth user group. What do you think? I'll be like, no. But get a feel for the water, figure out what's out there, what the need is, and then go do it. A lot of people say that, I could never start a meetup. I could never do a community group. I could never do a community day. It's not easy, but it's not impossible. It's just like every other elephant, one bite at a time.
All right.
That's a bad analogy. I should stop using that analogy. I'll go with something else next time.
I don't think anybody actually is going to eat an elephant based off of that. So we're probably pretty safe on that.
Are we? Okay. Phew.
I don't know.
Chris said to do it. I got an elephant. I'm going to eat it.
Well, if people want to know more about you and what you're up to, where can they find you in the world wide web?
Mistwire, MISTWIRE. If you Google that word, I am the first like three pages of Google hits. I have the blog. That's my handle on everything, Instagram, Twitter, all the things. So if you can remember Mistwire, that's how everybody finds me now. Even my own mom.
Awesome.
What's Chris doing today? Oh.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for being a guest with us today on Day 2 Cloud.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to our guests for appearing on Day 2 Cloud. And hey, virtual high fives to you for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, we'd love to hear them. Hit us up on Twitter at ECBanks or at Ned1313, or fill out the form on my fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. If you like engineering-oriented shows like this one, visit packetpushers.net/subscribe. All of our podcasts, newsletters, and websites are there. It's all nerdy content designed for your professional career development. Until next time, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.